Hi, welcome to Motive and Method. I'm Dr. Xanthi Mallett, and I'm doing this brief introduction solo because Tim is actually busy doing his day job. He's off in court. So this is just a brief introduction to an episode that we recorded with Dr. Michelle Reuters a little while ago. And it needs a little more context because since we recorded this episode, which focuses on the case of Kelly Lane, Kelly has actually been denied parole. That happened a couple of weeks ago. So we just wanted you to listen to this episode with that context in mind, as that was not the status quo when we recorded it. We hope you find this interesting, and thank you for listening to Motive and Method. Welcome to this week's Motive and Method. This week, we're going to be talking to Dr. Michelle Reuters, who's from the Bridge of Hope Innocence Initiative at RMIT. Now, they've been working with Kelly for a number of years now, so we're going to continue that kind of deep dive into the case. And Michelle is going to bring us right up to date with where we're up to now. So welcome, Michelle. Thanks so much for taking time to join us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
It's our pleasure. Tell us about the Bridge of Hope Innocence Initiative at RMIT. When did you start it and why did you start it?
We started in 2014, and we started probably because I'd seen a documentary on the Innocence Projects in the US sometime before that. And when the opportunity came along, I was so inspired by what I'd seen. And this was in the early days of the US project. I just jumped at the opportunity to do the same.
And so you obviously felt the need to start an Innocence Project here, but how hard was that? Because I went through the same journey at the University of Newcastle, and it was a journey. You know, it wasn't easy setting up such a complicated initiative. So how was your experience at RMIT?
Actually, it was a bit different because it was such a novel concept. I think it no one really knew what it was that I was doing. And consequently, I just set it up and it just grew.
And grew.
And because we take student interns, we really solve a lot of universities' problems in offering authentic work integrated learning experiences for students. And I think that had a lot to do with our success.
So what sort of cases do you take on?
We take on any case. They don't even have to be indictable offences. So commonly murder, a lot of sexual assault cases, they would be the main cases that we have. Other ones would be drug offences, simple assaults, and the like. We don't take certain cases. So, for example, we don't take cases involving child pornography, and we don't take cases that involve any kind of risk to the students or us. And that's purely because we are an educational body principally, and we've got obligations, you know, to our students.
Yeah, health and safety of the students has to come first.
That'd be a tough call, though, if somebody's charged and convicted of murder, for example. I guess it would depend on the context of that alleged crime, whether you'd take them on or not.
Oh, we've taken on all, I know that sounds a bit odd, we've taken on all the murders. Well, you know, we certainly reviewed them. We wouldn't exclude on that basis, but certainly if there's any risk that, I guess if I put it this way, if we find out that somebody didn't do a murder, then somebody did. And if there's any risk of that somebody, you know, perhaps finding out who we are and where we are, then that can pose potential risks. So we would weigh that up in the process.
Yeah, and we've had to make some of the same calls at Newcastle, actually, because we modelled our project very much on yours. And obviously we've known each other now for a number of years, and I've come down and seen how your project's worked, and it's fantastic. And we have the same benefits at Newcastle. You know, the student experience of work-integrated learning, and we also take a lot into the programme, and that helps the uni out now, because obviously everyone's got to do their learning, you know, in the real world, as it were. So it's a fantastic project. And obviously you've got a lot of cases now, one of which is Kelly Lane. When and how did you get involved in Kelly's case? Because obviously, you know, she was prosecuted in 2010 and you weren't in existence in 2010. So what was your role and how did you come into it?
It came up quite quickly. Kelly is one of the first six or seven cases that we dealt with. And she approached us soon after her application for leave to appeal to the High Court was refused. And that was very much a quick inquiry. And then a road train with all of her materials coming down from Sydney. That was an exercise.
So what merit did you see in Kelly's case in those early days? Something obviously piqued your interest, or was it just it's the sort of case you would take on?
It's definitely the kind of case that we would take on, but the first thing that struck us, even on an early reading, was where's the case? Just looking at it, couldn't understand how the case had got to trial, let alone how she could have possibly got convicted on the evidence that was presented. And that really piqued our interest.
Well, I remember reading Winston Terracini's comments in the Court of Appeal. I think she was going for bail then. And he said, there's no possible way that you will secure a conviction. No evidence, weak circumstantial case, and no motive. I mean, what was the motive? She wanted to be an Olympic swimmer
or
something.
Which wasn't even a motive, because that wasn't even true.
Alleged motive.
Yeah. So, yeah, for everyone listening, we have nobody, obviously. Tegan has never been found, so, you know, that's an issue. No body case is incredibly difficult to prosecute anyway. We have no witnesses that any crime of any description was committed, let alone murder. There's no evidence. It's the only case I've ever come across where it's the absolute absence of anything which led to somebody being found guilty. It's quite incredible.
Oh, it absolutely was. And not only was there no motive, there wasn't any evidence supporting the fiction of a motive that the Crown presented. And, so it's to this day, I simply don't understand how the jury could have found on the basis of that evidence. Actually, I do have some ideas, but...
Yeah. We may be not discussing those now. Maybe that's over a glass of wine when we next see you. Yeah.
Not in the public domain.
Yes, yeah.
But how do you work through a case like Kelly's? You mentioned the train of documents that were sent down to you. There must be an enormous amount of work involved just to get to square one.
It was enormous. To this day, it's still the largest case that we've had because most of it was in was physical, was documents and whatnot. And it took me a month working full time to unpack the materials, put them into some sort of categories that we could analyse it. So we don't, we have a process where we don't start at the trial and look at what went wrong there, because clearly everything went wrong there. We go right back to the beginning and reconstruct the case, and that means teasing it apart and putting it together in analytical categories that we can go through systematically. And that took so long.
So how many hours do you reckon that you've worked and your team of students have worked on this case so far? Have you got a ballpark for how long you've spent on it?
It would be thousands, incalculable. To give you an example, we've got boxes of the school searches.
Tegan.
Yeah, looking for Tegan. Okay, Tegan. And all of the material that went out to the schools and the responses that came from the schools and all the documents associated with that, it's boxes and boxes and boxes. And each one of those boxes has many pages with lines of information about individual, students and other people. So just systematically going through that line by line by line, reading the material, listening to the recordings. Our aim, and you'll be familiar with this, Xanth, is that we want to read everything. We want to read everything that wasn't read. Because I think probably the listeners might not understand that defence lawyers at trial don't get time to read the entirety of their case. They're lucky if they get to read a portion of it or only select parts of it. And so by the time something goes to trial, no one on the defence side has ever had an opportunity to read absolutely everything in that case.
Yep, or listen to all of the phone conversations. So at Newcastle, we've had groups of students listening to phone conversations and transcribing those because, you know, they've never been listened to before. And I feel your pain with the hours, because one case we have at Newcastle, we've spent over 5,000 hours on it so far, and we haven't been on it that long. You know, we haven't been in existence as long as RMIT's Innocence Initiative. So, yeah, 5,000 hours and counting on that one. It's an extraordinary amount of time, but we have the resources with the students to do that, to have those eyes over everything that obviously defence simply don't have. Yep. But one of the problems we've come across is actually accessing information. And I imagine that is something, a bit of a brick wall that you've also hit. Is that something...
That was my next question. We have a hive mind, but are you confident they give you everything? And what sort of stone walls do you encounter in obtaining the evidence?
That is the pain point, Tim.
Yeah, yes, it is.
And anyone familiar with the case would know this. What we found out in Kelly's case pretty early on was that it was massive non-disclosure by the police. So that the police not only didn't disclose all of the recordings or only partially disclosed recordings that were made, telephone intercepts in Kelly's on Kelly's mobile phones, listening devices in the house, but they also didn't disclose the existence of other warrants and other recordings. So potentially thousands of recordings just were never shared with the defence. They did a little thing where they disclosed very late in the twilight of the trial and then finally disclosed an actual number that the defence might have been able to work with. But by then it was too late. No one was going to be able to listen to all of those recordings. And they did it in a very sneaky way. They just kind of snuck it in, making it impossible.
It's very tactical. There's nothing accidental about this. They've had the recordings for however long and then they only hand them over at the last minute when you can't really utilise them.
What drives that, do you think?
Wanting to win, I would think.
Oh, well, I get that, but they're not model litigants either, are they?
No, they're certainly not. No, no.
And in our case, so we immediately did what everyone would do is we FOI'd, we lodged a Freedom of Information request, was refused, went back again, asked for review, was refused.
What grounds did they refuse you?
That it was too much work, essentially, to go back and, you know, dig the recordings out. And their argument was for us to know whether or not you can have access to them, we'd have to listen to all of them again. This is despite the fact that they had the recordings and they had the transcriptions, but they would have to listen to them again before making a decision to give them to us. And eventually we ended up in NCAT on both on the listening devices and the telephone intercepts. And we were not successful. And the argument was pretty much the same in both cases. In very simple terms, it was, unless you can tell us what's in there that's so important, you really don't have much of a case.
Oh, so unless you tell us what's in there because you haven't listened so you don't know what's in there.
Yeah.
Oh, so frustrating.
Who drove this, the Crown or New South Wales Police or both?
It was... I think it would have been driven by the police, but obviously it was driven by legal advice as well.
So can you describe the original trial process? I mean, what in your opinion went wrong? Because it's, as you say, as we've read, it's a case that should never have got up.
Everything went wrong from the very beginning. I've got a news article on my wall. I'm just looking at it over there. From 2014, the first problem Kelly got was no one wanted to act for her, and she might have even had to go on as a self-represented litigant.
Is that because she was an alleged baby killer? So it was just so unpopular?
I think it probably had more to do with the volume of materials. It was such a difficult case, and probably also that it had a lot of press as well. But it was very, very difficult. So you know, you really have to, I think, kudos to the defence team and did pick it up, because no one else wanted to touch it. So that was the first problem. And then, you know, we had this really unusual situation where the Crown prosecutor opened with a highly prejudicial opening address, and he speculated in his opening address that Kelly could have killed and buried Tegan at the Homebush Olympic site, which was under development. Because that was close to the hospital when she was discharged. And that was objected to at trial, and the Crown Prosecutor accepted that was inappropriate. But the problem was that the defence had an opportunity to apply to have the jury discharged at that point and didn't take it. So there's a lot of this forensic decision making that not just Kelly's defence lawyer, but other defence lawyers make at trial, and you can't go back. No. Like they're stuck with those decisions, and unless they're palpably bad. You know, you're stuck with them.
I would say that was palpably bad, though, because obviously we know that, you know, you implant something in the jury's minds, and there was no evidence that she'd done that. It was just he had to come up with something that she could have done. Yeah, something visual for the jury. But obviously by them being told to discount that, you actually further implant in the jury's mind. You can't suck it back out.
You can't unhear it.
You can't. In fact, they make it worse by saying discount that. Mm. So it's so prejudicial. But it was right there up front and centre at the very beginning.
Yeah. And there have been similar occurrences of the same kind of speculation, speculative and prejudicial narratives. So that was probably off on the wrong footing then. The second one was attaching the, attaching the perjury charges to the application and to the indictment, sorry. And what that then allowed the Crown to do was it exposed Kelly, it allowed in all of the previous pregnancies and the histories of those children, and exposed Kelly to an enormous attack on her credibility that might not otherwise have been there. Although, and that was hugely.
That creates an image as well.
It does, but there are two ways to look at the other pregnancies. So for the listener, there were two pregnancies that she had abortions for early on. Then there was a third child that she adopted out legally. Then there was Tegan. And then there was another child that she adopted out legally. And so a picture could be painted of somebody who's just having, you know, becoming pregnant and not taking responsibility for that necessarily. Or there's a picture that can be painted of somebody who actually is managing that situation. And so from the path of least resistance, criminologically speaking, I have never heard of a situation where somebody would adopt a child out, for example, choose to murder the next child, and then, back to adoption. So I think there are two ways to paint that particular picture. It could be made to look bad, or it could be made to say, why would somebody do this? Why would somebody in their right mind do this? And there was no sign there was any psychological issues. So why would you kill a child when you can simply adopt it out, leave it at the hospital? There's no necessity, there's no motive. There.
Well, it's sort of linking in a bit to Professor Sir Roy Meadows.
Oh, don't say his name. Don't say that man's name to me.
Perhaps you can ask that question. But we've had a bit of an analysis of Sir Roy Meadows over the preceding podcast.
Yeah, he keeps popping up. Do you think that was part of it, that kind of a young woman not taking responsibility, you know, and how she was being viewed by the media and by the public and that whole negative picture being painted? Was that part of this?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the perjury charges there were obviously to introduce, consciousness of guilt. But the problem was the counter narrative was never really put clearly. And so, as you said, Vance, this showed someone who was taking care of those children in an appropriate way. So and I think what wasn't clear, those early terminations were intensely traumatic. For Kelly. Like, she was very young and it took her a lot to get over it. And that's why she moved to the fostering and adoption for the next child. And so when the opportunity came for her to ask the father of her fourth pregnancy to take care of that child, that was most appropriate. And that's why she didn't seek an intermination, and that's why she didn't seek an adoption. Because that was the arrangement. That counter narrative really was never presented.
Because that seemed really obvious to me when I read the case. I was like, this makes no sense. This makes no behavioural sense to me. And I don't, Tim, what are your thoughts on that from a criminal psychological point of view? Would you expect that pattern of behaviour?
No.
That was pretty succinct.
I wouldn't. It doesn't stack up, and you don't have a body. I mean, it's. The whole thing was based on emotion, wasn't it? And playing to the emotion of the jury, and the person who was most articulate seems to have won. What were the key issues with the prosecution?
Well, it wasn't a lot. It was centred around motive, that she killed Tegan because the baby was going to interfere with her sporting life, her social life, and her career, and that she had a fear of being rejected by her family. But And you know, they relied heavily on the fact that, you know, she left the hospital without Tegan. Right? There's, you know, the absence of the explanation. But all of that hinged on Andrew Noyes mm-hmm. and the fact that they clearly didn't believe in the Andrew Noyes story from the very beginning. And I think what has not been clear from the start of any of the coverage of Kelly's case is the police inquiry wasn't about finding Andrew Noyes. It was about proving that he didn't exist. And so all the early searches for Andrew Noyes were really incredibly narrow. They were looking for very specific detail, which meant that they already limited those inquiries. So it looked like it was exhaustive. You know, they went to immigration. They, you know, went through all of the records. They didn't take into account that he might have been using a different name at the time of his relationship with Kelly, or that she could have got it wrong. I don't know about you, Zanth, but I don't know the surnames of a lot of, well, let's not use the word a lot.
How many of the people have been, Michelle?
But, you know, it just doesn't come up. And what was probably most telling, at no time when they were building all of these profiles of the Andrew Noyes and all of the photos, at no time did they go back to Kelly and ask her, is this the Andrew Noyes? You know, is this where we should be, you know, pursuing our investigation?
And they predetermined the outcome.
Yeah, they had a narrative that they wanted to fit, you know, the information fit. Yeah. And we should say that he may well have lied about his surname because he had a partner, didn't he? So he was having an affair with Kelly. So he had every reason to maybe not necessarily be entirely honest with her about his name. And you're right. I wouldn't necessarily remember all my boyfriend's surnames, to be honest with you. You know, they're done. So you've moved on.
Wasn't important.
You're very harsh. I remember everyone's
surname. Oh, really? I'm sure.
Yeah.
More or less.
I mean, other critical factors there were that the police sent out formatted and semi-completed statements to all of those Andrew Noyes's. So they were pre-prepared for them to fill in. And the other was that three times the police asked for Kelly's telephone records in the early days of the investigation, and three times they put a stop on it.
So the police put a stop on it?
Yes.
Why was that?
So they didn't want the records?
Well, one was it was her mobile phone records at the end of – she had a mobile phone from December 1996, and they decided that was outside of the time frame, so they wouldn't bother with it, even though Kelly had said she was in contact with Andrew Noyes afterwards. Mm. They got asked for records of her partner's at the time phone and then discontinued with those. They didn't get – the school mobile phone that she had, because she was a Saturday sports coach, so she would have had a mobile phone, the school phone, her parents' phones, and the other phone that she had at the time.
So really they didn't want to find him?
I think it's hard to conclude otherwise, Zanth, to be honest.
Yeah, that seems like you know, that's naturally where your brain goes. And if you're really looking for someone, you actually collect the evidence and go through that. If you don't want to find them, you don't bother, right?
Or you don't believe the story.
Or you don't believe the story
from the get-go, and we're not going to waste time on this. What were the key issues then for the defence trying to pull a non-prosecution case apart, I guess?
Well, I think, to be fair, they tried the best they could, but they didn't call any defence witnesses.
Now, that's a problem here, isn't it? Because the one person who may actually have known about Andrew Morris Norris was swapped out. This blew my mind when I heard this. And I don't think the listeners will really understand what goes on in a court case and the swapping that goes on. You know, I won't lead this if you don't lead that. Now, that happened here, didn't it? So can you just talk us through that? Because I could not believe the defence swapped out this witness.
Okay. So there were two witnesses in play, if you like, in this handshake deal. There was an Andrew Morris who'd come forward and said that he knew Kelly, and they had had, I think, a fling on the beach. But as it turned out, he had nothing to do. Like, he had no connection with Kelly whatsoever, and that would have been easily determined. And on the other hand, we had Natalie McCauley, who was Kelly's lifelong friend, to whom Kelly had spoken about Andrew Noyes and the issues that she was dealing with. And the defence, and once again, this is this forensic decision-making, they decided it was optimal for to make a deal that they would not call Natalie McCauley, who was going to be originally a prosecution witness, in exchange for the prosecution to be calling Andrew Morris, who was in fact value neutral for anyone. He had nothing.
So he's a waste of time as a witness. He's not going to help either side. Natalie, on the other hand, is pretty much Mother Teresa, correct?
Yep.
So
yep.
She is this incredibly upstanding citizen. Didn't she work in Africa with like ill children or something? She is literally like the most reliable witness. She's going to come across really well to a jury. She's going to be very believable. No wonder the Crown wanted her swapped out, because she was the one person who could say, I knew about this man when Kelly was seeing him.
Well, it gives it credibility, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that drives it wide open potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I could not believe, of all the people to swap out, she was the one that got swapped for basically a nothing. Like, it could not do Kelly any damage.
And you can't understate the importance. So the prosecution is saying, we think it's you because we've got no believable explanation about what happened to this baby. And on the other hand, we've got someone who can support Kelly's argument about the existence of the other parent.
Which at the very least creates some doubt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And a very credible witness. And, you know, the jury never got to hear that. And I think most people in the public would be shocked that these kind of deals are done and not all of the evidence that's necessarily relevant ever makes it to the jury.
Yeah.
Oh, it's theatre a lot of the time. And I'm not sort of trivialising what she's been through, but a lot of the time trials can descend into theatre and, you know, the thespians are at play. But that's an extraordinary deal to have done, given that that's your one light on the hill, isn't it, of possibly getting an acquittal. Your key witnesses dealt out of the pack. It's crazy.
So they didn't lead any other witnesses at all?
No. No, they just relied on cross-examining the prosecution witnesses.
And obviously Kelly didn't give evidence in her own defence, which is totally normal. She would have been advised not to do that. Mm. But that can also be used against people, can't it? The optic of that, not wanting to speak. And knowing, I mean, I've met Kelly a number of times now. She's incredibly eloquent and intelligent. And personally, I think if I'd been on that defence counsel, I think I probably would have encouraged her to speak, because I think she would have resonated with the jury. And I think that would have been, in her case, possibly a good move.
The problem is, once you're in the box on oath, they can ask you anything.
I know.
It may have nothing to do with the case at all.
But they already had it out there. They already had it out there about the other children. I mean, so they'd already ripped her life apart and, you know, her as a person, as it were. And once you do get to meet her, I think you get a different impression than you do of the woman walking through that press pack every morning to get to the jury, to sit there silently and stoically. She's a very strong woman. And they were definitely the ghost of kind of the Lindy Chamberlain, the Kathleen Folbig, you know, being judged because you're not crying, you're not distraught, you are kind of holding it together. And I think that particular visual was very negative for Kelly, and I think that speaking would have actually helped her. I don't know. What do you think, Michelle?
I agree 100%. And they relied on, you know, this apparent evidence of her lack of distress. And there's just shades of Lindy Chamberlain and Kathleen. And I think it has to be said that the police and prosecution approach to this case has been appalling from the very beginning. I think they've minimised women's experience of trauma, and they've effectively suggested that any woman who's previously made the very traumatic decision to either terminate a birth or put a child up for adoption is therefore capable of murder. And that's outrageous. And that's the narrative.
Yeah, it's disgusting. You know, women make these very difficult choices for all sorts of reasons, and that's totally up to them. And yet to have that used against you in a murder inquiry, there's, you know, a world of difference between adopting a child out, obviously, and being capable of something like that. But that's the narrative that was ultimately painted. And there were other issues, weren't there, with the Crown putting forward a number of points that they said that Kelly had to demonstrate that these weren't true. Now, that's what we would say is reversing the onus of proof. The defence doesn't actually have to prove anything. However, that was what the Crown suggested. She has to prove these things. And, you know, that's actually not how the trial process works. They have to prove that guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, that's right. But unfortunately, that argument wasn't successful either in the Court of Appeal or in an application for leave to appeal to the High Court. And they did, I think it was in the Court of Appeal, they did distinguish it from Gordon Wood's case where the same thing happened, where there were 50 questions. And
same prosecutor too.
Same prosecutor. And the questions there were that the Crown prosecutor was effectively asking Gordon Wood to establish his innocence.
Yes, exactly, which is when I looked at this case, I was like, it's not up to Kelly and her defence counsel to establish that she didn't do this. The onus remains on the prosecution. But I think he successfully flipped that. The narrative was very cleverly done. And I think he basically, the Crown outmaneuvered the defence. And I think, you know, I think that happens when you have very high profile Crown prosecutors. I think they can make the defence feel nervous and, you know, a bit outgunned in essence.
It's a very thin line that they walk because the Crown prosecutor was warned about this approach in the Gordon Wood case and then yet still adopted it in this case. And I think going back to the opening address, it's impossible to think that this didn't resonate with the jury.
Yep, absolutely. But the judge did have issues with this, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Anthony Wheely, yeah.
Yeah, he did have reservations. But unfortunately, as that played out, and I think he gave very careful directions to the jury about that. But we just simply don't know what was in the jury's mind.
No, and we never do in Australia because you're not allowed to speak to the jury. So you never really get to unpick what happens, you know, in that jury room afterwards, which is a bit of a shame. It would be great if we could understand more about the dynamics of jury rooms.
How long did they deliberate? I'm not aware of that.
I think it was a while. I don't have that. I didn't actually look at it, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know that one either, actually.
Yeah. But it's a good question.
Yeah. So at the moment, Kelly obviously has no more avenues of appeal. So what stage are RMIT at with her case? Because you're still acting for Kelly, aren't you? Because she still wants to clear her name. She's eligible for parole next year in May. She's eligible for parole in May 2024. So where are you at now and where are you going and what are the hopes for this case from RMIT's perspective?
We're still hopeful in the same way we have been from the beginning, having a review of the case having the conviction overturned for all those reasons. We did get stalled a bit by COVID. Mm-hmm. That slowed a lot of the process down. We have a petition of mercy which... part of the reason that didn't progress is because we were waiting for the results of the Freedom of Information applications because we needed that information to assist that. But now that Kelly is, when Kelly is out, that'll just give us far more opportunity to go back to scratch.
And do you see any parallels with the Kathleen Folbig process? Because obviously Kathleen has now been released. I'm thinking more about... how the case has been judged and the reluctance to have cases such as this reviewed correctly. And I think there's a massive problem there, particularly with cases where women are accused of harming their children. And so do you see any kind of parallels there in the fact that Kathleen has now been pardoned and released? Is that something, do you think, that can be leveraged maybe in Kelly's favour?
I think it should. In Kathleen's case, her diary... took excessive significance.
Ridiculous.
I mean, unrealistic significance. And so you have exactly the same situation and the same prosecutor again, where mm-hmm. you have a fictional motive based on like slim, neutral material that can be easily interpreted, you know, either way, depending on who's playing with it. And a wholly circumstantial case with absolutely no links between what has been alleged to have occurred and the outcome. And also innocent explanations in both that appear to have been completely discounted. The accidental deaths in Kathleen's case and the very real likelihood that Tegan and Andrew are happily unaware of any of this.
So why do you think we haven't been able to find Andrew, Norris and Morris then? Because I know you've been looking, other people have been looking. Occasionally things come across my desk that I might pass on to you because people are getting in touch. So how have we not found him? Because it's quite likely that if Tegan is out there, she doesn't even know necessarily that she's Tegan Lane. So that there's an explanation
Absolutely.
For that. And we don't know who we're looking for. We don't know what she looks like. we don't know what her name is. So that there's an explanation for not being able to find Tegan, but why can't we find Andrew? Can he be living under a rock and not have heard about this case?
Well, maybe he didn't want to be found.
I think both of those, Tim, but certainly there's one poor gentleman. I keep getting his photo a lot because he looks a lot like the identikit, and hopefully he's not being harassed. But I think it's because living in this world that we live in, it's easy to assume that everyone must be aware of this case. But in my day-to-day life, I think 99% of the people I talk to have never heard of the case and have no idea. And it's entirely possible that Andrew Knowles, and even if that actually is his name, is existing very peacefully somewhere in Australia or New Zealand
or somewhere else overseas.
Yeah.
Could have just moved overseas, doesn't think anything of it, takes his daughter. Because people say to me, oh, but, you know, he should have adopted her and how can she give up her baby to the father? And I go, so would we be having this discussion if a father had given up his baby to the biological mother and would we then be saying, well, this is an awful thing to do? Or would that be a totally natural thing, in fact, to do? And if the mother then left the country with the baby, we wouldn't think anything of that.
We tend to judge women very harshly.
We do.
When they give away children or injure children.
But this is the biological father. He has equal rights over that child that Kelly had. So, yeah, I think it's surprising to me when people go, oh, that's awful. You know, she couldn't have just given it. Well, you know, men do it and we don't blink, do we? So, you know, I don't think it's that shocking that somebody could. And I've talked to lots of people about this case and they go, oh, yeah, I vaguely remember something about that. And it's like, I guess we live and breathe it, don't we? It's like, how can you not know about these cases? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that was part of the reason why, obviously, we work with the ABC to and get that identikit photo out. And the more that that series is viewed on Netflix and the BBC and anywhere else, the more likelihood that someone will recognise the name and the person.
So, do you think Kelly Lane was wrongfully convicted? And if so, why?
100% Kelly Lane was wrongfully convicted, and they were convicted because the prosecution didn't have a case. The lead detective on the case admitted as much. The Crown prosecutor has admitted since that the police investigation was flawed and inadequate. He's done that on a couple of occasions, even one of his novels. And simply there was no case. There was absolutely no material linking Kelly to a murder in any shape or form.
Yeah, I have to say I agree. And I can't even remember. I mean, we've known each other a long time now and I can't even remember how that relationship started. But I know that I wrote about this case in my book in 2014. I also raised issues in Kathleen Folbig's case. And obviously it must be through that mechanism that somehow we got in touch. And I totally agree. There's no evidence of a crime having been committed here. And I was frankly shocked when I saw that the successful conviction was the outcome in this case. It still blows my mind that this could happen.
It's not the first time, is it?
No, and it worries me it won't be the last either. Yeah.
Do you think the attitude towards women accused of killing their children has shifted at all?
I'd have to say, not judging by a lot of the discussion around both Kathleen's case and Kelly's case.
What recent discussion? Because certainly that would be my experience going back a year, 18 months. But in the last year, the discussion around Kath's case certainly shifted. You look at the social media responses when it was out in the media again, and that vitriol and vilification that, you know, any conversation around Kath used to raise, it did die off, and now people generally accept that she was wrongfully convicted, and she's now a mother that has been in prison for 20 years for four awful crimes that she didn't actually commit.
I think part of that too is the genetic evidence and science, and it gave people a hook to hang their hat on.
But there was always reasonable doubt. There always was.
You and me and Michelle and probably people who work in this space, absolutely reasonable doubt. Yeah. But I think the general perception in the community is that, you know, good women don't do this sort of thing. There can't be an alternate hypothesis. And you go for the most obvious one, even though it's not. And I don't think it's changed at all. I think there's lynch mobs out there hunting for women.
Oh, there certainly are.
You know, there's an attitude that's entrenched. And, you know, I don't know how you shift it. Better education.
Well, I think Cass case has helped to shift it, and I'm hoping that that may cause a shift in the way Kelly's case is seen too, because, you know, just people having being a little more questioning, being a little more critical. You know, okay, well, there wasn't ever any evidence in Cass case that she caused intentional harm to those children. You know, that was always the case, but the public didn't understand it, and there was never any case to answer in Kelly's matter either. There was no evidence, and I'm hoping that maybe there's a shift coming, or I don't know. What do you think?
I would have to hope there was a shift coming, but I agree with you, Tim. I think in Kathleen's case, there's science for people to hang their hat on, say, yep, this is an explanation. But there's still that kind of, I think, perception about Kelly that she did this deliberately because she wanted to maintain that kind of lifestyle. And a lot of that has to do with the media profiles. Mm-hmm. But going back to the idea of proof beyond reasonable doubt, we'll never know how damning or an effect that reversal of the onus of proof, those 10 questions, had on the jury, because it opens the door for the jury to convict even if they don't find reasonable doubt, because those questions were not addressed, despite the direction to the jury.
Yep.
Well, the seed's planted once again. It's a bit like the body is buried at the Homebush Olympic site. You can't unhear it or unsee it, and it's highly prejudicial.
Yeah. So do you think the only way then, potentially, for Kelly to clear her name is to find Andrew Norris Morris, or whatever his name might be, or find Tegan?
Well, obviously that would be the ideal, but I'm hoping that there will be other avenues to review her case. Going back to the procedural issues associated with it, it's really time for the system to have a look at, you know, the cultural problem police have with non-disclosure. Mm-hmm. We've seen that with the Lawyer X case.
Yes.
That was a real problem. And, you know, the jury didn't get to hear all of the evidence because it was never shared with the court.
Well, same with the Kathleen Folby case, diary excerpts being cherry-picked from the diaries to present, okay, they could look suspicious on their own. You read them in context, you think about who has written this diary. It's a woman who's incredibly traumatised by the loss of multiple children, and she's expressing feelings of guilt. Well, that's not a shock, is it, really? When you think about what she's writing, why she's writing it, it's not guilt of having harmed them. She's guilt of not being able to protect them.
Well, eventually it was a psychologist who said, look, this is evidence of grief, not homicidal intent.
Yeah, so it's all about that context. So if you're going to give the jury diaries, give them the whole diary. Don't give them cherry-picked excerpts, because it's misleading, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you an example in Kelly's case. One of the listening device conversations, I think there was something like an actual 380, but only I think 7 were disclosed. And of those 7, 2 were for takeaway and 2 were for phone calls that she made to the Australian Tax Office.
Oh, wow. I mean, exciting stuff.
Yeah.
And she's leading a thrilling life, isn't she?
Hang on.
Yeah. Who rings the tax office twice?
So it's just the impact of that. And the other, procedural issue is, like, how long can we keep going with an idea of having a prosecution based on a narrative and circumstantial evidence only?
Yep. It's hugely problematic. It always worries me when it's purely circumstantial, no matter how compelling it may be. And we've talked about the Lucy Letby case, you know, very compelling circumstantial case, but it still makes me twitchy because it all looks, you know, so strong in those early days. But what happens if in years later we find out that something wasn't presented to the jury or there's somebody else who had access to those children? It just causes me anxiety when that is the only thing that they've hung a prosecution on for multiple murders. Doesn't get any more serious.
Absolutely.
Well, it's still on the horizon, but, you know, somebody's charged over William Tyrrell. Nobody, circumstantial case. Let's wait for the stitch-up.
Yeah, I know. It causes me fear, the criminal justice system in this country and other countries, you know, but certainly I think reform is desperately needed, and Kath's case, I think, is the poster child for that at the moment. It's like, how badly wrong can we get it before we do something to change it for the better, to prevent there being another Kathleen Folbig? Because that just, we can't have those kind of egregious wrongs.
Decades later. Years you can never retrieve. It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Other countries have conviction integrity units, so where they investigate the safety of convictions immediately afterwards. So not years later when everything is lost, but, yes. you know, really situated close to that conviction and sentence.
So is that something you'd like to see in Australia?
Absolutely. The closer to the actual conviction, the more likely you are to get a positive outcome because the material still exists.
Yeah.
You know, everything is still there. And so we've got conviction integrity units in America, but also other systems have it built into the court process.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be, I think that would be fantastic here because we certainly have an issue.
We've discussed it before, I agree.
Yeah. So that's where we are with Kelly at the moment. Obviously, she hasn't been released yet. That's hopefully imminent, although she may come up against the nobody, no parole laws that were brought in the wake of Chris Dawson's conviction for murdering Lynette Dawson, his wife. Was that last year? The years go so quickly. So it'll be interesting to see what the parole board do deciding in Kelly's case. Was there anything else you wanted to add before we wrap up? Because this case is not over, obviously. And, you know, this is just a bit of a pause while we wait for the next move, I guess.
Probably just maybe a parting comment on our observation of the cases that we see, which might accord with your observation, Xanth, is that people who are genuinely innocent or people who have experienced genuine miscarriage of justice never stop. Mm-hmm. Like it's because they are in prison unfairly and unjustly, and Kelly won't stop clearing her name, and will be there supporting her in that fight.
Yeah, as will her other white knights, as I like to describe them, the people on the outside. Yes, Well, good comment to end on. I think. Thank you so much for your time today, Michelle. I mean, I don't think there's many people who know this case quite as well as you do, and it is. It's quite a one.
Encyclopedic knowledge has been very interesting.
Absolutely. And such an important case, I think, in Australian criminal history for all sorts of reasons. It raises all sorts of problems and things we really need to look at on a systemic level. So we're really appreciative of you taking the time to talk to us today. And thanks so much, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks very much.